thought tonight I'd talk about what the Buddha called the seven factors of enlightenment. You may or not be familiar with this list, particular list, but it's a very important list, very good list to know about. The seven factors that he enumerated are these: mindfulness, investigation, energy, rapture or pleasurable interest, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. In the Pali Canon, there's a story of a monk who was quite ill, and the Buddha went to see him, went to pay him a visit, and asked the monk how he was doing. Was he getting better? And the monk said, no, he thought he was getting worse. And so the Buddha talked to the monk and gave him a discourse on these seven factors of enlightenment. And so, as it states in the Pali Canon, at the end of the discourse, the monk was feeling a lot better, and his illness had abated. We might ask ourselves why, or indeed how, it is possible that that kind of thing could possibly happen. And so what I'd like to do is to not give you an answer to that one. What I'd like you to do is to perhaps just bear it in mind, and perhaps you can discern for yourself what it was that took place that meant that the monk could indeed get better. On another occasion, a different monk asked the Buddha why the seven factors of enlightenment were called the seven factors of enlightenment. And the Buddha replied, because they lead to enlightenment. Seemed like a perfectly reasonable reply. Indeed, these seven mental qualities are necessary capacities that meditators develop through meditation. They are necessary to develop in order to come to the cessation of suffering, to find freedom from suffering. We need to remember, always bear in mind, that the Buddha only taught one thing. He taught suffering and the cessation of suffering. So everything that he talked about, all the ideas that he put forth, were all based around bringing meditators, bringing willing individuals to the cessation of suffering. He maintained that we suffer whenever we resist life, whenever we say that it should be this way or it shouldn't be that way, whenever we say, think, passionately desire life to be different than it is, that is when we suffer. He maintains that it is through not understanding life, being ignorant of life, not seeing life as it truly is, that was the trigger for this passionate craving, for wanting life to be different. He maintains that actually life is perfect as it is, and that through observation of our experience, our subjective experience, the here and now, right now, we can come to that realization of the way things really are, and therefore the craving that is dependent on the ignorance, which has now been got rid of, disappears. So he forged a path, a way anyone can take based on living a sound ethical life, developing the culture of the mind through meditation, learning how to stay put psychologically, stay put in the moment rather than going off here, there and everywhere, learning how to calm the mind and keep the mind in the here and now, so that we could examine our own personal subjective experience, the ongoing experience of living, mind and body, observing actually how it all works. So, enlightenment is nowhere except here and now. It just can only be found here and now and nowhere else. It's got nothing to do with the future, it's got nothing to do with the past. It's about developing a dynamic awareness in this moment in order to see and understand exactly how life works. And so we're given a basic instruction which really encompasses everything that I've just said. The basic instruction is to rest content in the moment, watching the arising and passing of things. So simple. And yet, the reality is, for anyone who's tried it, it is that it's very difficult to keep the mind resting content in the moment in order to observe the arising and passing of things. It's not very easy at all. There are obstructions. I've written out a list of the kind of obstructions that we might encounter. By no means exhaustive, but I'm sure one or two of you will probably readily testify to experiencing some of these. Tension, agitation, laziness and sleepiness, doubt, depression, elation, frustration, irritation, fear, I think it's undoubtedly the case that when we first come to meditation, and probably for a fairly long time after we've begun meditating, we have expectations. We have expectations about what meditation is, expectations about what enlightenment might be. We have ideas. We project those ideas onto our experience. So perhaps we might be sitting in meditation with the view that meditation is all about being calm and tranquil and delightfully serene and blissful and deep and glorious. And yet we're confronted with a mind that can't stop worrying about something inane, like whether they fed the cat, or something terribly mundane like that. What happens? We had this idea of meditation being a certain way. Expectations are dashed by the reality. And so a judgment is formed, a comparison is made, a judgment is formed. This is wrong. This isn't what meditation should be about. And of course, then we start to manipulate the meditation, the mind, trying to get it into the shape or the pattern or the picture that we imagined that we thought meditation ought to be. And this pattern can occur in so many different ways. We're ingenious in the obstacles that we create. Meditation. So One person might try to force the meditation, try to control what's going on in order to make it what they believe it ought to be. Another person might take a completely different route, the opposite route, rather than putting way too much energy in, and might choose to forget the whole sorry business, sour grapes attitude, and maybe turn in for the night. Let the mind fall into fantasy and daydream and forget about the difficulties of meditation. There are so many examples I could give. Perhaps one more I could give perhaps is the idea that some people have when they come to meditation about enlightenment being some form of annihilation. That somehow, through sitting quietly with your eyes closed, that because we've heard that it's all about the eradication of self-view, well, it is about the eradication of self-view, but sometimes it's misinterpreted to be the eradication of the self. And so that they think that sitting quietly, watching the breath arising and passing away, that somehow they're being annihilated. And so great, whenever they try to see it, great fear arises. Well, it's understandable, given the assumption. I do wonder quite how they get to sleep at night, based on that premise, because they might not wake up in the morning. But of course, therein lies perhaps the solution to our dilemma. They do wake up in the morning. They're aware that sleep is for 7 or 8 hours, that it's perfectly natural. And they have direct personal experience of waking up, so that they know that actually there's no harm in... After all, you think about it, when you go to sleep, when you're in deep sleep, there is no consciousness then at all, is there? It comes back, doesn't it? With all these obstacles, with all this comparison about what we think should be in the meditation and what isn't in the meditation, there is always an ignorance, an ignoring that's going on. There's an ignoring of the fact that the painful feeling that you don't like is transient. There's an ignoring of the fact that if you pay exquisite attention to whatever it is that you don't want to be in the meditation, it instantly vanishes. It doesn't stay. It doesn't hang about at all. But when we ignore, and when we passionately crave for life to be different, we unbalance the mind. At that time, there's no possibility of any mindfulness. There is a strong, passionate desire for life to be different. So the way out of the dilemma is to learn to be mindful of the things, whatever wants to arise in the meditation. To learn to be mindful of the painful things, to be mindful of the pleasant things, to actually reiterate again and again that calm states, clarity, insight itself, mindfulness itself, are all impermanent. So if it is that the meditation does actually go the way we want it to go, what can often arise is a passion, an elation. Oh good, I'm finally calm. Of course, which just immediately destroys any calm that there might have been. So in order to remain calm, you have to give up the attachment to calm states. If it is that you don't want the meditation to be painful, then it's paradoxical, but what you have to pay attention to is the painful feelings, to observe the fact that the painful feelings are indeed transient. See, it all boils down to self-concern. It's what concerns us. And so we have to examine our experience and come to understand these patterns. We all of us have our own particular favourites. And this is very important, because as we pursue the insight path and we learn how to meditate, we will find the same obstacles reoccurring throughout our campaign. No, that's, isn't quite the right word. But throughout our journey, that's more spiritual, isn't it? Journey is more spiritual. Throughout our journey, what was I going to say? Throughout our journey, we will experience these patterns again. What happens is they tend to become more subtle, but it's still the same generic pattern. So learning about these obstacles has to be included as part of your spiritual journey. It's very telling when you conduct a meditation interview with someone and they don't talk about the obstacles or what's opposing their meditation, because they consider that to be a failing on their part, when in actual fact the teacher would really like to know about what the obstacles are, because through discussion it's amazing what you can actually come up with and how you can help progress the meditation. But some people feel reticent about owning up to irritation or frustration and doubts, these kinds of things. But in each and every case, the obstacles are overcome through the development of the seven factors of enlightenment. It's through developing these seven factors that it's possible to overcome the obstacles and therefore be free to rest content in the moment, watching the arising and passing of things. Four, firstly, if you want to understand where it is that you're craving for life to be different, you have to have clear awareness. You have to have mindfulness. Clear awareness of one's current experience. And that's clear awareness of both physical and mental activities. The only way you can develop mindfulness is through trying. Or anyone has done who has become successful at becoming mindful and has got mindfulness established as a way of life is because they tried. It's because they kept setting up practice, they kept intending, and that's the way you get mindfulness going. It's a choice. You just choose mindfulness time and time again. And the very best entry point into mindfulness is mindfulness of body. So becoming aware of the sensation of touch. Just as right now, perhaps there's a sensation of the thighs against the chair, or the back against the back of the rest of the chair. Just immediately brings you into the moment, doesn't it? Immediately. So simple. But of course, we can't do it if we want life to be different than it is. But what is it that we should be looking at? Well, the moment we become aware of body, we've begun to investigate our experience, which is the second factor of enlightenment. There are two aspects to investigation. Firstly is study. So if you want to know what you can, it is possible to be mindful of. And it's suggested that you do some study. I would fully recommend the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. It's a very good entry point. If anyone would like to know where they can find details of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, they can either ask myself, Brother Nigel, or Anda, or Sarah. The other way of investigation is, of course, experience. The moment we become mindful, We start, say, with mindfulness of body. We can begin the process of observing the transient nature of all bodily experiences. And as we become more familiar with the body, so we become more familiar with what's going on in the mind. It's an automatic process. You can't help it. Whereas perhaps normally our default setting is thinking, thinking, thinking. When you become mindful of body, you immediately become aware of what it is that you're thinking about. So it is you leave the content of the thinking and are able to observe and analyse the process of thinking itself, which is a very important part of the practice. So seeing the transient nature of the thoughts as well. If we get it right, then our energy, the third of the seven factors of enlightenment, our energy becomes balanced. Which is to say that we're not using our energy to try and get rid of things. We're not using our energy to try and create things. We're simply using enough energy to pay attention to what is happening at this moment. Just as, quite effortlessly, unless you're away with the fairies right now, you're listening to this voice, just that is sufficient energy. It's just being here, in the moment, observing what's going on. That is quite sufficient energy for the task. That's what we mean by balanced energy. Neither too much, nor too little. So if you're investigating rightly, not trying to change your experience, but just observing your experience mindfully, and noting the kinds of experience that occur, then one's energy is balanced. And what meditators find, and I hope you've had some experience of this, is that when the energy comes into balance, what arises is rapture, the fourth of the enlightenment factors. Rapture, sometimes called zest, sometimes called pleasurable interest, is a sense of joy, thrill, a subtle thrill that arises. Sometimes there can be a sense of floating, or at other times a sense of sinking. It's not different from, say, when you listen to a piece of music with rapt attention, because it's a beautiful piece of music, and perhaps the hairs on the back of the neck stand up a little bit, and there's that sense of rapture. The only difference is that this kind of rapture is supersensuous. It's not the product of having a nice, pleasurable experience so much as just having got the energy balance correct. But if the energy is correct, then pleasurable interest arises, which is the fourth of the seven factors of enlightenment. Now, with this subtle thrill, there isn't really much sense of wanting to be anywhere else. The idea of craving for another kind of state when you've got this lovely, joyful, pleasurable thrill. So what tends to happen is that both mind and body become tranquil. A pleasurable interest is helping the mind remain in the moment. It's kind of refreshing the mind, keeping the interest, keeping the meditation dynamic. So there is no sense of wanting to be anywhere else. And the meditator finds that this lovely bodily tranquility arises. Like all the aches and pains just seem to just recede. And the body becomes very light. And there's a beautiful sense of calm in the mind. A lovely calm, peace. It's like the town's gone on holiday. It's like everyone's down tools. There's this lovely sense of peace. At that time, there's no wish to be anywhere else at all. And that's the fifth factor of enlightenment. Now, given that body and mind are so tranquil, is it any wonder that concentration should arise? You think all the obstacles to concentration, all that distracted thinking, thinking about the past, thinking about the future, what room, what desire is there to go off the rails in that way? When the body and mind are tranquil, it's actually very easy, a lot easier, to focus the mind in an undistracted way. So Vipassana, insight meditation, what do we focus on? Of course we focus on the transient nature of mind and body. And then finally, I think this is where it all comes together. Being that there is such a sense of concentration, there is such a focus in the mind, given that the body and mind are so tranquil, and there's genuine interest in being in the moment and observing the arising and passing away of phenomena in a mindful way, a delightful equanimity arises. Equanimity is evenness of mind. It's being there in the middle. And it's a delightful mental quality where there is no sense of needing to change anything or interfere with the process at all. And so people, as they develop the meditation, find that they can sit quite happily for long stretches watching the arising and passing away of things. And when it becomes really quite mature, there is a sense of the whole thing just taking place by itself. There's no need to interfere in the process at all. And that's the seventh factor of enlightenment. Now, to begin with, we have to deal with the obstacles through a fair amount of restraint, recognizing when we're wanting life to be different, restraining the urge in order to be able to observe the things, both pleasurable and painful, and see their transient nature. As these seven factors begin to develop, as our understanding of the arising and passing away of things develops, all these seven factors begin to operate in the most delightful unison. It's like they're all different parts of the whole process. And as I was saying before, these obstacles, these patterns, come with us all the way through the journey of insight meditation. But there's a point that's reached, and it's reached four times, where the equanimity becomes so strong and the mindfulness is so strong, and the investigation is so strong, and all these other associated factors are so strong, that the meditator is able to observe quite clearly the processes whereby suffering arises, how craving arises, in such beautiful detail that they see it clearly, just exactly as it really is, as being entirely conditioned and transient, that they completely let go of that craving or that hatred. Now, letting go means perfect acceptance of the way life is. So no fighting, no thinking it should be different, seeing quite clearly that the whole process is completely anatta, meaning it is completely non-self. There's no one there doing it, it just happens. The whole purpose of the training is not to create another kind of state. The whole purpose of the training is just to see perfectly clearly, with utter clarity, exactly what's taking place. So, what we're talking about here is understanding, realizing, not creating a particular state, but realizing the true nature of how things operate. It is just as the Buddha said. The answer to the whole problem of suffering is right here, right now. What we need to do is create the most conducive supporting conditions, setting aside the ignoring and the craving through personal restraint if necessary, in order to develop these seven factors of enlightenment. And when they come to their full development, that understanding is so clear and so precise that it destroys the craving completely. It is the knowledge in the end that destroys the craving, the understanding, for just simply being, observing clearly exactly what's going on. So we have seven factors of enlightenment: mindfulness, investigation, energy, pleasurable interest, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And anybody who begins and continues to develop mindfulness, and therefore begins to investigate, will develop all seven of these factors of enlightenment. Yeah, I think I've pretty much mentioned everything I wanted to mention. It is a case of understanding the true nature of all states. All states have the nature to arise and pass away. The realization of enlightenment cannot be described. It can't be described for a very good reason. The realization is that there's no division and no separation anywhere at all with anything. In fact, you can go so far as to say, in reality, there are no things. There's the appearance of things. But the realization of Nibbana is that there's no separation and no division anywhere. If somebody attempts to describe that, they necessarily have to delineate. That's what language does. It separates, it divides off. So we can say this is one thing and that's another thing. So if we say that enlightenment is pure love, we've delineated enlightenment as being this thing called pure love. Now, in actual fact, enlightenment is pure love. But if you delineate anything, then whatever you create has the nature to arise and pass away. In fact, it ceases immediately the moment you delineate it. So any way of trying to describe enlightenment, even accurate descriptions, are in actual fact inaccurate. You cannot describe it. And whatever you describe, whatever you delineate, is entirely unsatisfactory because it is transient. It's undoubtedly the case that people who do find and realise enlightenment do experience the seven factors of enlightenment. They most certainly do. But there's absolutely no confusion that what's being spoken of is, in a sense, inaccurate. So, of course there's mindfulness. Of course there's investigation. Of course there's balanced energy and rapture and tranquility and concentration and equanimity. Of course there are those things. But you can't tie enlightenment down to being a particular state at all. In fact, you have to abandon, in the end, all your descriptions of what you think the world is. You have to abandon your attachment to whatever it is that you've delineated and given such importance to. If someone has given great importance to enlightenment as being pure love, in order to find that pure love, they have to give up their description. You have to be completely free of any description. Because you think about it, if you want enlightenment to be love, but you discover that sometimes there's love and sometimes there's not, you'll always still be chasing love. So you'll always be missing the love that's right here, that's always right here. So in order to find it, first you have to abandon it, whatever it is that you consider enlightenment to be. And it is pure love when you find it. Oh, I've been talking for too long. I hope some of that was useful.